From 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory. Welcome to Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. Chances are, if I say to you the word feud, the one and most certainly the very first word that will come to mind, or first thing that will come to mind, will be the Hatfields and McCoys. The tragic yet most fascinating clash of families in American history. But speaking of history, most of us know, truly know, very, very little about this legendary blood feud. And hopefully you didn't rely solely on last year's cable TV series, because as we'll learn from our guest this hour, an awful lot of myth remains in this story about the Hatfields and the McCoys. Best-selling author Dean King has set out to set the record straight in a new book that critics are already calling the definitive work on the Hatfields and McCoys. The book is called simply The Feud, The Hatfields and McCoys, The True Story. Dean King, welcome.
Chris, it's great to be here with you here in Charlotte.
Thanks so much. Why is it so important that we know the true story about the Hatfields and McCoys?
Well, you know, this is one of our foundation legends, really, as Americans. Yet there is a lot of history behind it, and there's a lot of accurate details that have often fallen by the wayside because the stories are just so salacious, And so what I wanted to do is really restore the reality to the history.
We'll agree with the description there that there have been, over the last 125 years, indeed many myths associated with the Hatfield and McCoy feud?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's intrinsic in something of this nature, in a feud of this nature, where you had, you know, really terrible violence, you had crimes committed, and, of course, you're going to have all different versions from either side, from the families. You're going to have people who perpetrated things who wouldn't talk about them. And to this day, there are people who are giving me information who will say, look, I've got this. It's been in a box at my grandmother's house. We don't talk about it. I don't want anybody to know I have it, but I'm going to give it to you. You can make copies. You give it back to me, and I'm going to put it back in the box.
Wow. So set the scene for us. Who are the Hatfields? Who are the McCoys? Where? What happens that sparks the feud that would last for over 100 years?
This all took place on the Tug River, which separates West Virginia and Kentucky. And as the myth grew, it became sort of black and white. Hatfields in West Virginia, McCoys in Kentucky. You know, but that's not really true. There were more Hatfields in Kentucky than there were in West Virginia. It just so happens that the family involved really directly in the feud, the Hatfield side, was in West Virginia. And that McCoy family that was really involved in the feud directly was in Kentucky. But it was a community where the people were strongly integrated. There were Scots-Irish, McCoys. The Hatfields were English. They came there. You know, they're first families of Virginia, the Hatfields. You know, they've been here a long time. They fought in the Revolutionary War. And, you know, there's this myth that they were sort of, you know, toothless, moonshining hillbillies. But they weren't. These were powerful families in their own communities. They were intermarried, which I think really fueled the feud and made it that much angrier. You know, you can't get madder than you will at your in-laws and, you know, your family when things go wrong. So it all happened there. There's a lot of debate about when the feud started. And for me, it started in the Civil War. There was a McCoy who was killed by the Hatfields at the end of the Civil War. And a lot of people will say, well, that didn't start the feud because that McCoy fought for the Union and everybody else around there fought for the Confederacy. But that's one of the untruths that's been sort of over the years. It's just been perpetuated. A lot of the McCoys on the Kentucky side and the Hatfields on the Kentucky side all fought for the Union.
So, and the time period again was immediately after the Civil War?
Yeah, well, this murder was at the end of the Civil War, and people will also say, well, that didn't start the feud because the McCoys didn't avenge this death. But this is typical of a feud, is that somebody will die, a father, and his sons 15, 16 years later will come back to avenge the death. And that's exactly what happened in this feud. And then later there was a dispute over a pig, and really the 1880s were the decade where it was really fierce and fiery, and where you had, you know, a dozen people were killed, you had house burnings, and some really egregious murders.
Let's mine into that, no pun intended, a little bit more. 1880s, 15 years after the end of the Civil War, and a whole thing about a pig?
Yes. You know, there was a bitter dispute over in this part of the Appalachians. People raise hogs. Hogs are essential. You know, you can think it's just a pig today, but back then, to get through the winter, you needed your pig. You needed to be able to slaughter your pig and use that, the meat, the fat, every bit of it to survive these really brutal winters. These people were, you know, they were isolated, and they hunted, and they grew some crops, but, you know, they're in the mountains, so they needed all the nutrition, and so these pigs were important. But what they did was they let them roam. And they would feed off the mast, the nuts and things in the forest, and then they would go get their pig in the fall when it cooled down, and they would slaughter it and hang it and prepare it for the winter. So it just so happened that there was some confusion over the pigs, and Randall McCoy accused a guy named Floyd Hatfield, who became known as Hog Floyd, of taking his hogs.
And it ended up how?
So they got into a bitter dispute. It went into court, and you know, you had magistrates.
This was what
year
exactly?
This was in 1878.
1878.
Yeah, and so what happened was the magistrate, who was a Hatfield, you know, there weren't many families in this area, realized that he wanted to have a jury trial. He didn't want it all hanging on his head, so he got six McCoys and six Hatfields in the jury, and so they listened to both sides. And it turns out one of the McCoys sided with the Hatfield, and that McCoy worked for Devil Anse Hatfield, and so that became a real. It made Randall McCoy, the patriarch of the McCoy side, really bitter, and there was vengeance wreaked after this. The McCoy who sided with the Hatfields ended up getting shot, and so that started the murders.
At that particular point, that would last in earnest for the next dozen years.
Yes, yeah.
And you were saying that the 1880s in particular were a very bloody time for this family feud.
Yeah, you know, and it was capped by my prologue in the book is actually a hanging, a public hanging of one of the Hatfields, which really ended the feud. But this guy was kind of a sacrificial lamb. He was an illegitimate son of Devil Anse's brother. He was a violent guy, but he was also, they called him a half-wit. So he wasn't mentally fully capable. So really he was a sacrificial lamb in the feud. But in those dozen years, you had several really bitter fights. You had a Romeo and Juliet episode, and then you had this house burning, which then made the national media, and that's when the Hatfield-McCoy feud really became, you know, went worldwide.
Prior to this time, prior to the Civil War, in the 1840s, the fact of the matter is the Hatfields and McCoys occupied those areas either from Scotland or Ireland or England, in the case of the Hatfields, occupied these areas in the late 1700s. They lived in peace and harmony for
Absolutely.
The first 50, 60 years that they were over here, correct?
They intermarried. They did business together. They got along. You know, they needed each other. This is such harsh terrain and so remote that they depended upon one another. But basically, and one of the things I had to do in writing the book was really get in there and experience the geography. I went in there, and the Hatfields took me up on the ridges. And to understand it, they're these very narrow valleys, and you go up, they call them hollers. And so these people were really isolated up these hollers most of the year. And when they got together, all the social things had to happen. And you had a lot of moonshine drinking, you had courting, you had fist fights, you had the whole works, and it was these intense, you know, flash moments. And that's when a lot of the feud, you know, big events took place. They would come down for elections or funerals or weddings, that sort of thing. And that's where a lot of it happened.
So much of this, of the feud that, especially during the 1880s, was actually covered by national media at the time. They had heard about it, but it had heard about it happening in such an isolated, remote area of Kentucky. And at that time, it was, West Virginia. But speak about that isolation. I mean, there were people in the larger towns in Louisville and Frankfort, Kentucky, that were shrugging their shoulders, as I understand it, about hearing how the Hatfields and McCoys were feuding so violently in the mountains of the two states.
Yeah, this was such an inaccessible area that, even people in Louisville or Charleston, West Virginia, you know, just shook their heads and said, you know, those people are different. And, you know, they were appalled but they just couldn't really relate. It's like, let them fight. You know, they don't really have anything to do with us. But it was an important area because after the Civil War, there had to be a lot of rebuilding done. And the forests in this area were some of the most magnificent in the country, in the world. And when you see pictures, there's some photographs of the trees. They look like redwoods. They're immense. And so both families were loggers, and they would cut these trees down, float them down the Tug Fork to the Ohio, to the sawmills there. So there was some real industry that started happening there after the Civil War, and the railroads then started coming in, or they started to plan to come in the 1880s, and the property started the value started rising. So it was an area in flux, in change. You know, it was going to be modernized to a certain extent.
But speaking of the railroad, didn't the railroad and the telegraph even bypass this area because it was so isolated, so rugged?
It had been bypassed, you know, and the trains had gone across the country and they just skipped this area. So, you know, because it was just too rugged, it wasn't worth going in.
And to this day, you can't even pick up cell service up there.
No. You know, you got to, you know, I stay in a little place in Matewan, West Virginia, there's a little inn there and it's about 15 yards from the train tracks. And every night, 5, 6, 7 coal trains go by. Your bed shakes when they go by. And the first time I was sitting on my bed, the bed started shaking. I thought I was having a heart attack, you know, because it shook before I could hear the train. Mm. It's so close. But to get cell phone, you've got to walk down to the track, and you can get a little cell phone activity there. But consequently, the people in the area don't even own cell phones.
I'm just wondering if it was because it was so isolated, was the reason why the Hatfields and McCoys sort of resorted to frontier justice, the attitude of mountain justice, that they did not feel connected to the rest of the country and that all of the issues that were going on between them had to be settled between them, and that they chose to do it in the way that they did it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you had to be self-reliant.
They didn't turn to Charleston, West Virginia, or the capital of Frankfort, Kentucky, or Washington, D.C., for that matter, resolve their differences.
Well, interestingly, they would use the local court system to solve some problems, but it was always sort of a fallback. Or if I can get it done in the court, okay. But you knew underneath that if they felt their honor had been insulted, or you know they were going to take care of it themselves, and so they would call the family together and they would take care of business. And you know, in one instance, you know, three of the McCoy boys murdered one of the Hatfields, and the sheriffs were going to take them to Pikeville to put them in jail for a trial, and Devil Ann's Hatfield said no. I'm gonna go get those guys. They're not going to court. If my brother dies, I'm gonna get them.
That is going to be something that I want to explore in the next segment of Charlotte Talks. We're talking with Dean King, author of the book, The Feud, The Hatfields and McCoys, The True Story. And we're back with our discussion on Charlotte Talks right after this.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. Support this hour comes from WFAE members and the Harvey B. Gantt Center's inaugural symposium with Henry Louis Gates, Finding Your Roots, a discussion about individual lineage and American history. June 27th, 6:30 p.m., Knight Theater. Tickets at gantcenter.org. We experience colonial life in North Carolina and hear from someone who's hiked 1,000 miles from the state's mountains to the coast when Charlotte Talks, Monday morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. And have a listen to our newest podcast, Authentic South. Follow along as Atlanta-based host Tanner Latham traverses our region to find and tell its stories. Click on the podcast tab at WFAE.org for more.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, analysis of President Obama's national security speech, response to tornado damage in Oklahoma, and an IRS official takes the fifth in a House investigation.
Tune in for the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dean King, author of the book, The Feud, The Hatfields and McCoys, The True Story. This book, your last book, Skeletons on the Sahara, was published about 4 years ago.
I had one in between called Unbound about the Long March across China.
What I was impressed most with is the absolute detail by which you have carried this off. The research had to be exhaustive and very, very time-consuming. So tell me, have you been working on this, though, for how long?
3.5 years. Yeah, I love the research for Skeletons on the Sahara. I went to Africa, unfortunately, right after 9/11. It was a very strange time to be there, and I traveled across the Sahara, retracing the path of the shipwrecked captain. I then did Unbound, which is about the Long March across China, and I went and did the fiercest part of that ever, the tallest mountains in western Sichuan province. So for me, you know, I do spend a lot of time behind the computer, but I love to get out there and do the research, and then I love to get out there and take it to the people.
And talk to me about the research process. What does that mean in this instance to take something that occurred 100, 125 years ago? Are you talking to people? There are not that many written records, or are there?
There are some pretty good written records. But when I first started looking into this story, I realized that the best narrative account was done in 1949. And there have been some other good academic accounts since then, but there also have been some family versions of the history. So I realized there was a good amount of written material, and that's the first thing I take in. I absorb all that. I want to know everything there is to know. But there's a lot of oral tradition, too, and I suspected that there was still a lot more out there. So the toughest thing to do, the thing I really needed to do, was break the ice with the Hatfield and McCoy families. And so my family is originally from West Virginia. I'm from Virginia. But one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was to reconnect with the state of West Virginia. When it gets in your family line, something about West Virginia, it just draws you back. Maybe a little bit like Western North Carolina, too, where the mountains, and there's just something about it that when you feel that connection, it stays. And so I wanted to go back to West Virginia, and I talked to some friends of our family, and this one guy who's a heavy truck dealer in Charleston to the coal industry. And when I told him I was going to go down to Matewan, he said, "I better come with you because the people are different down there. It's going to be dangerous." You know. And of course, I went to Charleston. He was like, "I don't think I want to go." You know, that should have been a sign, you know. But I had found two private forest rangers who took me in the first time. And we went down there, and we went to where Thacker Creek meets Tug Fork. And, you know, it was a place where one of the McCoys had been murdered, and I wanted to see it. And I'm down there taking notes in my notebook, and all of a sudden we hear gunfire, and somebody starts shooting at us. You know, so, and we see the bullets hitting the water right beside us.
Oh, my gosh.
And my daughter, my now 18-year-old daughter, she was 16 at the time, Hazel, had come with us. So the forest rangers were very cool. They just said, "Dean, I think we better get her inside." We sort of circled around her. They wanted to save face. They weren't going to go, you know, hightailing it out of there. They just said, "Okay, we'll take a deep breath," and then we just sort of calmly walked away. So that was my initiation into this really rugged place in southern West Virginia.
And how many times do you think that has happened to others over the past 125 years?
Well, I'm sure it's happened to a lot of others for various reasons. As far as I can tell, I'm at least the second person who's been shot at while reporting on the feud. Another reporter from New York City had come down, and they warned him, "Go away, go away." And he said, "No, I'm coming in here to meet with Devil Ants. I'm just a reporter. There's no reason to fear me."
This is 1888.
1888, yeah. And lo and behold, somebody from the mountainside started shooting at him, and it was too close for comfort, and he decided to turn around at that time. What I decided to do was I realized I'd made a strategic error. You know, I'd gotten some forest rangers who knew the place, but I had to come in from the inside. You know, these were officials, and, you know, that's a culture clash between the officials and the locals. So I had met a guy who runs an inn in Matewan, West Virginia, and I asked him, I said, hey, I need to meet some real Hatfields and McCoys. And he said, well, I've got a guide who leads some of my people. ATV trails are big there. There's a Hatfield-McCoy ATV trail. And he said, you should meet this guy, Scotty May. And so I went and met with Scotty May, and he took me down. We got on his ATV. We went down and picked up a guy named Alvin Harmon. And Alvin comes out and straps a chainsaw to the front of his ATV, and he's got a pistol and a holster on his side and puts a jar of moonshine in his saddlebag, and off we go up into the ridges. And this was my real initiation into the family.
You're talking about this occurring, though, in 2008. So the question that I have about that is this a situation, is there still so much suspicion on both sides that anytime somebody comes in that you've got to choose which side that you're on as a visitor?
Well, you've got to be welcomed into either family. And I think I walked a neutral enough line. I mean, I love both families in the end. I met great people. And once they understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, they're very warm people. But there's still animosity. You know, if you start talking about the feud, the McCoy's going to tell it his way, the Hatfield's going to tell it his way. And if they get into it, you know, it can get ugly. So, you know, they're very sensitive about it, and they know their history.
So in doing the research for the book, did you talk to family members? Did you talk to descendants of some of these folks?
Oh, I spent a lot of time with both families. And these guys, Alvin and Scotty May, are a part of the Chafin family. Vicey Chafin was Devil Anse's wife. And so these clans are really close. They live up Mate Creek. Mate Creek flows into the Tug Fork at Matewan, and that was the main Hatfield Creek right there. That's where Devil Anse was born. That's where Ellison Hatfield Cemetery is. He's the guy who was killed by the three McCoy brothers. And so they're still there. They're still there, and they still really care about their history, and they want things marked, and, you know, and they're proud of it at this point, which I think they should be. You know, this is, you know, it was at times ugly, but this is American history, you know, for better or for worse, and it's important American history. So these guys, they took me up in the ridges, and I had to go up there to really understand the feud. You go up this tiny, narrow ridge in the middle of nowhere, really steep trails. They call them outlaw trails. People don't go on them unless you know them. They're not marked. And loggers sometimes fell trees on them, and that's why they took the chainsaw up there. We would have to chainsaw trees that loggers had put there on purpose to keep the ATVs out and push them over the side. But these guys, you're not going to stop them. They are freedom-loving people, and so they're going to go where they want to go. But they would take me up there and show me the places where the Hatfields would go up and hide. They call them rock houses under ledges, and you could go on the trail and not see a rock house. They knew where it was. You'd stop. You could go out on a ledge, look out over this beautiful view, and they'd go, okay, now let us show you the hiding place. And you'd have to bushwhack down beside this ledge, and you go underneath, and there's this beautiful cave down there with smoke, you know, black smoke up the side because they've had campfires there. And lo and behold, one's called Water Rock. There's a spring in it. So you could hide up in the mountain, and you had a water source, and nobody could find you.
To give a plug for someone who has written, I think it's Popular Mechanics of all books, has an article out in this month's edition, features you, and in some of the hidden places as it relates to the Hatfield and McCoy feud.
I thought it was important to preserve these places. So, for Popular Mechanics, I went and GPS mapped. They gave me a modern gizmo, you know, it was great. And I went up there and got coordinates for all these places. And they're graves out in the mountains. And, you know, this is an area that's being extensively coal mined. The coal companies and timber companies own all the property. So it's really important that we mark these graves in some instances before they disappear.
Some of them are indeed registered in the National Historical Register.
Yeah, yes, there's an important cemetery there, Devil Anse's Cemetery. And, you know, he became so wealthy off of bootlegging and timbering that there is a life-size marble, Italian marble statue that was erected on top of his grave by his family. So that's an important cemetery.
time and time again, you write so much that this, regardless of what the argument was over, it seemed to me to always go back to one side wanting to seek vengeance. How important was vengeance? Or was that the objective in the Hatfield-McCoy fight?
Well, the thing was, and you often see this in feuds, is it's all about honor. And, you know, in these remote parts, a man's reputation and what people thought about him and how he met certain challenges was everything. And so if he felt his family had been wronged, he really had to go take care of business. You know, he had to avenge that, or his reputation was ruined and anybody would walk on him. So these things were life and death, even if it seemed like a minor thing of a hog dispute or, you know, somebody not paying for a fiddle in one instance became a flashpoint, or a fist fight, you know, these things were important to them.
It does also speak to the fact, again, that because they are so isolated, that the justice that is rendered in the isolated mountains of Kentucky and West Virginia is vigilante justice.
Sure. You know, you sort of have this hothouse effect in this tiny little place. You know, everything, the gossip mill is, you know, so intense that, you know, and sometimes what would seem to be a minor offense that the law would just shake its head and go, well, just forget about it. Mm. They couldn't. You know, so they had to take care of that business, and the other side knew it was coming. So, you know, because they would be the same way. So, that's, I think, one of the reasons why we're so fascinated with this area. And, you know, when you talk about the reporting of the feud, it was also the time of Jack the Ripper in England. And so you look at some of the big headlines and you'll have Jack the Ripper and then you'll have the Hatfields and McCoys, and they were kind of competing. But I think we were fascinated, you know, on the one hand, we were fascinated by a psychopathic killer. On this hand, we're fascinated by this, intense, region of, you know, and what became the caricature hillbilly was there, you know, and just the world became fascinated, and that's why the legend grew.
And it does speak to, you have the chapter called Mountain Justice, and that chapter speaks to the whole rawness, the brutality, truly the brutality of that particular period. Tell us a little bit about that.
That
chapter is what I'm talking
about.
Yeah,
yeah. In that chapter, there has been a brutal murder. Ellison Hatfield, a Civil War veteran and a hero to the Hatfields, was in a fight with the McCoys. And it ended up three McCoy brothers. He was such a fierce big guy. Three McCoy brothers fought him, and they stabbed him 27 times and shot him. And he still lived for another 24 hours. And it was a pretty egregious crime. So the three McCoy brothers were arrested, but Devil Anse knew that even, you know, they were going to be taken to Pikeville, Kentucky. Devil Anse was in West Virginia. The crime was committed in Kentucky, and Devil Anse knew that if the boys got into the court system, and even if they were convicted, a lifetime sentence in those days was maybe 7 years. You know, people will joke that it was worse to steal a pig than to murder somebody. You'd get out of prison sooner. So they were arrested. They were on their way to jail. Devil Anse said, no, that's not going to happen. I'm going to get a posse. He put together family members, and they went and they recaptured these guys. They took them from the law, and they took them back to West Virginia.
Okay.
And they put them in a schoolhouse, and they kept them. And they said, and the McCoy family, Randall and Sally McCoy, the parents of these boys, came across and pleaded for them. Well, Sally did. Sally and the wife of one of these boys, one of them was married. And they pleaded for them and said, don't do this. Let them be tried. And Devil Anse said, if my brother dies, we're going to try them. If my brother lives, we'll turn them over to Kentucky, and they can be tried in court. Well, his brother died. And so what they did was they took them across the river back into Kentucky, and they took them to a pawpaw patch and tied them up there.
Pawpaw being a tree, a type tree?
Yeah, it's a large shrub or tree, and there you know, lots of them in that area, and it's become known by the pawpaw trees, you know. And so a firing squad shot them there. And this egregious sort of execution then sort of flipped it back. So the McCoys were the bad guys. Now the Hatfields are the bad guys. The Hatfields were all indicted for this crime, but they'd gone into Kentucky to do it. They were very clever. They go back to West Virginia. The indictments are in Kentucky. No Kentucky lawman is going to go into the hollers of West Virginia and try to arrest Hatfields. No West Virginia lawman is going to go try to arrest Hatfields. And the West Virginia politicians aren't going to do anything about it because the Hatfields are politically powerful. They can deliver votes to the governor. Mm-hmm. And politics is everything in these parts. So there was a stalemate there. All these guys in West Virginia were wanted. There were 20-some men who were part of that firing squad.
The Devil Lands had gathered together.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of them were his timber hands. Others were sons and brothers. And so they would still go into Kentucky at times because Devil Lands had a roaring moonshine business. And they would go sell moonshine over there. And they would go over to visit their relatives. No lawman would come down there and arrest them. Things heated up. There were more difficulties going back and forth. And finally, a McCoy – well, his name was Perry Klein, but he was part of the McCoy clan, who was a politically savvy guy, a lawyer living in Pikeville, delivered his area to the new governor of Kentucky and went to the governor and said, okay, now I want my payback. I want you to put a price on the head of the Hatfields high enough so that people will go arrest them.
Mm.
So, that vigilante justice, it simmered, what they did, it simmered for a while, and then it exploded in kind of a new phase of the feud.
Did not the U.S. Supreme Court get involved in that? Was that the point at which the U.S. Supreme Court got involved in the Hatfield-McCoy feud?
Well, what happened? Okay, so we get the prices put on the heads of the Hatfields. That is enough to get the bounty hunters interested. The bounty hunters come down there, and the Hatfields go, okay, this is getting to be a problem. This is heating up. We need to get rid of Randall McCoy because he's the one who's behind these charges that are being pressed. If we can kill him, then there really won't be anybody. Perry Klein's not enough to get this done without him. So they decided they were going to kill Randall McCoy, and they tried a couple times, and finally they mounted an all-out raid on his house. They went there on midnight, on New Year's Day of 1888, and they burned his house. They ended up killing a daughter and a son, and Randall got away. So they didn't solve their problem, but they just created an unforgivable sin in these parts. They killed an innocent woman, and that's when public sentiment completely turned against the Hatfields.
And what year are we talking about here? Is this also in the 1880s?
This is 1888. So what happened was you have Perry Klein back in Pikeville. Perry Klein hires a guy named Bad Frank Phillips. And Bad Frank Phillips is a little guy, but he's a mean sucker. And he said, you know what? I'm going to go arrest those Hatfields. Finally, you get a really courageous guy. He puts together a posse, and he goes into West Virginia. He arrests a bunch of the Hatfields. He then kills a guy named Bad Jim Vance. And Bad Jim had led who's an uncle of Devil Ants, had led the raid on the house and burned the house.
And let us finish this up on the backside of the break here. We're talking with Dean King, author of The Feud, the fight between the Hatfields and McCoys, and the true story. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins on Charlotte Talks, and we'll continue right after this.
Glad to have you with us this morning. You're listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, your source for in-depth news. Coming up on Diane Rehm at 10 o'clock, analysis of President Barack Obama's national security speech, response to tornado damage in Oklahoma, and an official at the Internal Revenue Service. Those stories and in the international news coming up on Diane Rehm. And support today comes from WFAE members and Accenture Credit Services, hosting an open house for experienced mortgage professionals Wednesday, June 5th from 3 to 7 p.m. in Charlotte. Details at accenture.com/mortgage careers. Take WFAE wherever you go with our app for iPhone, iPad, and Android. Get yours now at WFAE.org.
What's this?
Public Radio Remix. The best public radio stories, documentary audio, big ideas, and cool sounds.
Now they're both in a trance. Perhaps they're listening to another dramatic radio episode.
A new kind of public radio. Saturday, 9 to midnight on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks, Chris Clackham sitting in for Mike Collins, our guest, Dean King, author of The Feud, The Hatfields and McCoys, The True Story. You were talking about
Bad Frank Phillips. So Bad Frank Phillips goes in there to avenge these crimes and to arrest the Hatfields, and he does. He arrests a bunch of Hatfields. He kills Bad Jim Vance, and now you've got a real cross-border issue problem.
I mean, this is warfare. This is not just a feud anymore.
No. We're talking about, just to step back for a second, this area was so volatile during the Civil War because Kentucky was initially neutral. West Virginia was initially part of Virginia, and they were Confederate. So you have Kentucky then going Union. You have West Virginia going Union, but all the people in that area staying Confederate. And you have a tightly knit Tug Valley. And these people all knew each other, but they're on different sides. And so they're raiding each other, and it's all very personal. So there's just so much animosity and bitterness here. And these states were bitter about the war in the end. So this looks too much like the Civil War. Here you've got a cross-border raid, and the governors start getting into it, and the militias get called up. And so they're on the verge of going back to war. It's a big deal. And so you have a trial in Louisville. It goes to federal court in Louisville, and the whole thing then goes to the Supreme Court. And the result of this was that, Kentucky had wanted the West Virginians extradited, and the governor of West Virginia wouldn't do it. And now you've got Kentucky illegally raiding West Virginia. State sovereignty has been violated here. But West Virginia lost this battle in a way. And what happened was the Supreme Court ruled that no matter how a wanted person is delivered to jail into a courtroom, even if it's illegal, the court doesn't have to let them go because they're arrested illegally. It can still try them. Now, the people who illegally arrested those people can be pursued, arrested, and taken to trial. So they've committed a crime, but the court hasn't. So what this did, it's a little complicated, but what it did was it made it open season for bounty hunters to come down in this area. Because Bad Frank Phillips and his posse, who'd gone into West Virginia, they're now wanted in the state of West Virginia. The Hatfields are all wanted in the state of Kentucky. And since you can deliver somebody to jail and get your reward for it and then flee, because the people you're delivering the bad guys to aren't going to arrest you, they would take that chance. And so what you have is all these bounty hunters come down there because there are big rewards on the heads of these people, and you've got bounty hunters all over the place. And really, in the end, it's almost humorous, but the McCoys and the Hatfields almost allied against the bounty hunters.
Because?
Because they're these guys coming into their territory. It's almost like, now you're attacking our place. You're coming in from all over the place with these gunslingers, and raiding our homes. And this was a big violation of the code of the area.
Nothing can unite enemies like a common enemy.
That's right. And that's a great point. Right after 9/11, the Hatfields and McCoys issued a truce, an official truce.
2003, I think we're
thinking. Yeah. And it was because they said when somebody attacks the United States, even the Hatfields and McCoys will unite against them. And part of the reason for this is that, a lot this is one of those kind of areas where a lot of the young people coming up go into the armed services. These are they still have their Scottish and English traditions of, these were warrior type, soldier type families that moved over here, and they're going to fight for what they believe, just as they did in their home squabbles. They're going to fight for our country. They're so proud of the country. And one of the main Hatfields, Rio Hatfield from Waynesboro, Virginia, has a son who is in the military and went to fight these wars. And that was the impetus for putting together this truce.
What I found fascinating, what you just alluded to a few moments ago, is that while the Jack the Ripper case was going on in London at the time, in England, on the other side of the Atlantic, you had the Hatfields-McCoys going on this side of the Atlantic. But there was universal interest, at least some worldwide interest, in both instances?
Oh, yeah. You know, the hillbilly, the American hillbilly, was fascinating to everybody. And it really played into the stereotypes that Europe loved. You know, American, you know, hillbillies and homespuns and barefoot, you know, making moonshine and shooting squirrels, you know. They really loved that. And people in New York and everywhere else were fascinated, just as we are fascinated by mountain people now. They're wonderful in a lot of ways. Their wisdom and their crafts and all that. They're living sometimes in what seems to be a different age. So we're fascinated by that culture still.
But you say that the true kind of violent part of the Hatfield-McCoy feud really ended in the late 1880s, early 1890s?
1890, when one of Devil Anse's nephews was hung in Pikeville for these crimes. Others went to jail. I follow them further because it's fascinating. You want to know afterwards, well, what happened to so-and-so? What happened to this guy? One of Devil Anse's nephews became the governor of the state of West Virginia. You know, who would have thought that?
A Hatfield,
yeah. And then you have two of his sons who go on. They go into the trains are coming in, right? The railways are coming in. Two of his sons become railway guards because the railroads are like, who better to protect our railroads through this area than the guys who might be attacking them? Well, so they become guards for 8 years, and then they decide, well, this good guy stuff's not that much fun. They decide to rob a payroll master. They rob him, and they frame their boss. And they get away with it. They take their ill-gotten money, and they get into the whiskey business in a town, and they end up in a fight with the Italian mafia there, and they have a gunfight. These two guys and one of the mafia men gun each other down. And now in the cemetery, this broke Devil Anse's heart. And in that cemetery in Sarah Ann, West Virginia, where you have that marble statue of Devil Anse, there are two monuments of the two brothers right beside him. It really broke his heart. And so I think this kind of follow-up history was really important, too, to see what became of him. Some of them really made it, and some of them ended up in violent deaths.
But what remained was a tension, at least a tense suspicion, by both the Hatfields of the McCoys and the McCoys of the Hatfields for decades to follow.
Oh, sure. You know, I talked to people who, you know, would say, one woman in particular who said, I was in high school she's a Hatfield, and McCoy asked me to the dance, and I wanted to go with him. And my father said over my dead body, you are not going, you know, with McCoy anywhere.
Now, wait a minute. What was the time frame for that?
This is the 1950s.
Oh, my.
You know, so it continued, you know. And now, on the other hand, you have Hatfields and McCoys who married after the feud. So, you know, these are big families, and they're all over the country now, you know. But a lot are still in that area. And so you're going to have all, you know, a feud's not – one of the things I try to get across in the book is a feud's not a black and white thing. It's a complex emotional fray. And so you'll have some Hatfields and McCoys who get along. You'll have some that still hate each other. You'll have Hatfields and McCoys who will talk about the feud, Hatfields and McCoys who won't talk about it at all because their parents wouldn't talk about it. And, you know, all different. It's just a fascinating kind of murky thing.
But it does sound like to me that at some point in time they just decided to each go to each other's to corners, so to speak, and just not act out their emotions.
That's right. Well, Randall and Sally had lost a bunch of children, you know, five children killed. Can you imagine? They were heartbroken. They moved off the Tug Fork into Pikeville, and Randall became a ferryman there. And Sally, you know, she was brokenhearted. And Devil Anse moved away from the Tug River, too, because all these bounty hunters were coming in there. So he backed off into a further away area. So that really cooled things down to a certain extent.
Let's move forward, fast forward here. What are they up to these days? I mean, there have been don't I recall an episode of the game show Family Feud that featured the Hatfield and McCoys back in the 70s or 80s or something like that?
Yeah, they were on Family Feud. And now there's an annual family reunion. They have a tug of war across the Tug River, and I've been to the last three of those. And so, you know, you do have good people trying to get along, trying to promote the area. It is a fairly, you know, it's a economically hard hit area. So they're trying to create some tourism and get along as best they can. In fact, I'm now a producer of a reality show that's got Hatfields and McCoys coming together to make whiskey together legally. So that's going to air on the History Channel. But so that's bringing some economic development and more pride. Their Pride, the miniseries, was great for them.
Talk to me a little bit about that. Did it disappoint you in that they exaggerated or maybe romanticized some things that just did not happen the way that they portrayed them?
Well, you know, the thing is, TV is TV.
Sure.
And they made good TV. They made a show that people really wanted to watch and really got interested in.
We're talking about the drama, the Kevin Costner, Bill Paxton drama.
Exactly, yeah. The Hatfields and McCoys, three-part miniseries that broke all kinds of records and won Emmy Awards. And for me, generating that history, I think people know that if they want to get the real facts, you need to go to books, you know, and that's why I deal in that, in documentaries. But this, you know, because TV shows and movies are, you have to compress things. And so characters get compressed, events get compressed. And while it's not accurate, it does portray the place, it portrays the spirit of the people, and it gets people interested in the feud again. So I thought it was a great thing, really. And they did a documentary. I'm in a two-hour documentary that the History Channel did where we do talk about the real details. So it's all there. You know, now, hopefully with this my book, I think the history is as up-to-date as it's ever been. And, you know, I have new sources in here with real facts that, you know, have lain fallow since the 1880s in some instances.
Speaking of compression, the three main causes, alleged causes, for the famous feud between the Hatfields and McCoys were actually separated by as much as 12, 13 years.
And there again, you have something that's it doesn't appear that black and white. You can't say this happened, then that happened, then this happened. I sort of compare it to a three-legged stool. You know, you have this murder of this one guy. You've got this romantic failure and jilting, and then marriage of another cousin between the Hatfields and McCoys, and you've got the murder of the brother. And all these parts came together to create just so much tension that it was like a fire that you light in three different places, and boom, all of a sudden you have a bonfire.
What do you think is the fascination with the Hatfields and McCoys to this day?
Well, I still think you've got these sort of legendary American families. They're part of our sort of foundation myth in some reasons. Americans are tough. Americans are going to defend their turf. You know, you don't come after us on our own turf and get away with it. And, you know, we've shown that. And the Hatfields and McCoys are sort of that root stock. You know, these are tough people that you don't mess with, you don't offend. They take honor as a very serious matter. And I think Americans deep down are that way, even though, you know, we've lived in cities and we're much mellower and we use, you know, the court system and all that stuff. But deep down, we're just fierce people with a lot of honor and pride. And these people typify that.
And you've said before, but it's worth repeating, that they seem to gravitate towards the military, for example.
Exactly. You know, they're out there fighting our battles, and you know, it's part of their pride. They feel it's their duty, and in some instances, it's a way to get out of the hollers, you know, and to escape poverty. So it's been good for them. But boy, they're out there, you know, defending our liberties, and that's what's important to them. Freedom and liberty matters the most to them.
And speaking of getting out of the hollers, how many got out of the hollers and remain there to this day?
Hatfields and McCoys are all over the country. I mean, everywhere I go, I'm doing a 2,000-mile drive of the South with this book tour, and they're Hatfields and McCoys everywhere I go. And, we put out a little social media, and boom, we get, I'm the great-great-granddaughter of so-and-so, you know, because Devil Ants and his wife, Vicey, had 16 children, and the McCoys had lots of children, and there were cousins, and, you know, and so there are a lot still in the area, but they're dispersed all over the country now.
What other names do you look for other than McCoy and Hatfield?
Well, there are Vances. There's a Vance here in Charlotte. There are, Howards, Chaffins, Justices are all big names on both sides. And I've talked a lot about the Hatfields. I spent a lot of time with the Hatfields, but the McCoys are fantastic too. Betty Howard in Pikeville, Kentucky, is a genealogist. She knows more about the feud than anybody I've ever met, and I spent hours and hours with her, really reconstructing the details of the feud and getting into what was accurate and what wasn't accurate. So the McCoys really played a big part in this research as well.
Somebody who wanted to drive up to Pikeville, Kentucky, and this part of West Virginia, what would you advise them to do beforehand?
Well, I'd read my book, and you'll see all the sites you need to go see and some of the places you can stay, I think it's a wonderful cultural experience. I would take kids. I've taken two of my daughters there, and another one's going to come on my driving tour, because this is really Heart of America stuff.
What do you want people to take away from the Hatfield and McCoy story?
Well, I want them to take away that this is a fascinating part of our American foundation story. And for better or for worse, yes, at times it was very violent, but there are some, some of our roots, things that are important to us, come to light there. And it's just a fascinating event that we should remember.
Dean King, author of the book, The Feud, The Hatfields and McCoys, The True Story. Hope to see you down the road sometime soon.
Chris, thanks a lot. It's been great being here.
And excellent information. Do read his book. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. You've been listening to Charlotte Talks on listener-funded public radio, WFAE.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7.